Welcome back to the Hemingway List. I'm sneezing my head off. I think I've finished, though. So let's try this. It's the best podcast you've ever heard. If I sneeze a lot, I apologize, but I think I've finished, but I'm not sure. But maybe. We're talking about Book 1, Chapter 7. Is it just me, or is Julian kind of a dick? It's bloody 4:30 in the morning here, and I'm tired. I've just been on the treadmill or elliptical machine for like 2 hours. Watching Space Force, which is awesome, by the way. You should watch it. And that's my isolation update for you. My sleep cycle is the worst it's ever been in my life, I think. What were you doing? Yeah. Julian's a dick. Julian, kind of a dick. That's what's up. That's what's that. Sorry. I'm barely paying attention to what I'm saying. Swim, said the mama fish. He said, it's not just you. He's a dick. I also find it disheartening that Madame de Renal is so uneducated and that she was married off at 16. Emma Bovary was married off at 17. Anna Karenina, 18. And no, these ages are still amazingly young for the times. I need to find my post from Madame Bovary. There is a misperception, this is from Chapter 5, Part 1 of Madame Bovary. There is a misperception that on average women were married off in their teens. I found a paper, not possible to link, that examined the age of first marriage in Western Europe. It was 24 on average for females in 1820. Someone also had this to say. I've come across a few references here and there which tried to measure the actual marriage ages historically, and they often seem to come up with numbers that are perhaps surprisingly higher than we might expect. For instance, in 17th century England, Wikipedia notes that the survey of 1,000 marriage certificates showed the average age for brides was 24 and 27 for grooms. I've seen a number of other sources which have indicated the first marriage's ages were often in the early to mid-20s in part of Western Europe in the past few centuries. Obviously, this can vary significantly by region as well as time period. Based on data like this, my sense is that our perception of young marriage ages has been skewed by selection bias. We know more about aristocratic families, and they tended to arrange marriages in particularly young ages for political reasons and for financial as well. Wait, average? If it's average age, like they've just gotten all those 1,000 marriages and said, what ages are they on average? And it's 24. Wouldn't that suggest that there's heaps of people younger than 24 getting married? Like probably more people, there'd be more people under 24 getting married than over 24 because there's a cap, right? Like, let's say the lowest age you could get married is 14. So there's a lower limit, but then the upper limit would be, you know, 70 or 80. You could get married for the first time at, 80. Not that that would be common, but you could. So I think there would exist more marriages under that age than over that age, if I'm understanding how averages work correctly. Which means, right, that wouldn't that mean that there'd probably be even more people being married under 24 than at 24, even though the average is 24. But anyway, that's still interesting to note. And maybe I'm wrong, because I'm not very good at math. I can't even remember why we're talking about that. Why? Oh, yeah, because Madame de Renal was married off at 16. Can you imagine 16 to be married off, not even to want to get married, just to be married off and have no education? So you just completely rely on that marriage for the rest of your livelihood. Although she did marry the mayor. So, you know, it's not like she's been married into an awful life. She's married into a good, rich household. But yeah, still. Jan Brunt said, yep, he's a jerk, and I'm loving it. I just finished War and Peace, well done, and I'm sick to death of the most virtuous characters getting all the airtime and the minor interesting characters getting totally forgotten. Based on the back blurb, maybe The Red and the Black is a War and Peace if Boris were the main character. If Julian turns out to be an anti-hero, I am here for it. How modern. I would also love if this flirtation comes to absolutely nothing and subverts my expectations. yeah, that would be interesting. I'm so just like, that would be good if nothing happened. That would be a surprise, and that would be welcome, because the same thing keeps happening in this book. It's like Hemingway has a favorite little plot line, and it's a love triangle. Our treat said Julian is exasperating. So Fiati said he is kind of a dick. So much teenage angst. I hate everyone and the world hates me. Insert eye roll here. I don't like him so far, but the physical abuse he endures from his brothers breaks my heart. True. The poor boy has been beaten by his brothers and his dad. So you can kind of excuse him being a bit of a dick. Acoustic Eels says, I love how Julian comes up with a way to get free access to the bookstore while making it seem like he doesn't want anything to do with the bookstore. But for the sake of the children's education, he thinks it's necessary to have a servant go consort with such a liberal establishment. I am a little worried about Madame de Renal. She's gone through her teen years, been married off, and moved in with her husband, all without experiencing love. That means she'll be unprepared for it when it hits, and it sounds like that is any second now. It's funny about the bookstore, how anti-books they are because of the political climate at the time. Non-creative Handel said, second sentence in the chapter, nothing these urchins could ever do made him impatient. Made me laugh because I thought this was set the tone for Julian and his obnoxious personality. I'm holding out hope for some awareness to make it its way to Julian. His bratty personality is not very becoming. Yeah, he's young. He's going to have a, what do they call it? Character arc, character growth. So hopefully he'll change for the better. That's a good thing that a lot of these epic novels do, is they start with a character that seems kind of irredeemable, and then they redeem themselves. And I think that's a good thing. Sorry, I'm making a paper airplane while I'm talking. All right, concentrate. I think I only want to read half a chapter tonight because I'm knackered. Let me just see how long the chapter is. Give me a moment here. Sorry, that was gross. Yeah, I'm going to do a halfie. It's not a super long chapter, but I am really tired. So, there's that. Alright. So, we're going to read up until after breakfast. Alright. It's about, I don't know, 3 pages in. It says, after breakfast the next day. After breakfast the next day. So if you get to the next day and they've had breakfast, stop reading. Chapter 8, Minor Events. Then there were sighs, the deeper for suppression, and stolen glances, and sweeter for the theft, and burning blushes, though for no transgression. Don Juan, Cantanto, Stanza 74. The angelic sweetness that flowed from Madame de Renal's character and from her current state of happiness was only a trifle disturbed when she came to think about her lady's maid, Eliza. This girl had received an inheritance and went off to Cure Chelan to make her confession, telling him of her plan to marry Julian. The Cure was truly delighted at his friend's happiness, but extremely surprised when Julian said with a resolute air that he was unable to accept Mademoiselle Eliza's offer. "Be mindful, my child, of what goes on in your heart," said the curé, frowning. "I congratulate you on your vocation, if it is that alone which leads you to despise a very adequate little fortune. 46 years have gone by since I've been the curé of Verrieres, and nevertheless, in all likelihood, I am going to be dismissed. It grieves me, and yet I have an income of 800 livres. I let you know this detail so that you will not entertain illusions about what is in store for you in the priestly state. If you dream of paying court to those in power, your everlasting ruin is assured. You could make your fortune, but you must grind down the poor flatter, the sub-prefect, the mayor, the man of reputation, the cater to his passions, and cater to his passions. Such conduct, which society at large calls knowledge of the world, might, for a layman, not be absolutely incompatible with salvation, but, in our calling, it is necessary to choose. One must make one's fortune in this world or the other. There is no middle way. Go now, my friend, think, and return in 3 days' time to give me a definite answer. I dimly make out, to my sorrow, a sombre flame in the depths of your being, which doesn't speak to me of the moderation and perfect abnegation of worldly advantage necessary to a priest. I predict good things for your intellect, but allow me to say this to you, went on the good curé, with tears in his eyes, in the priesthood, I would tremble for your salvation. Julian was ashamed of his emotion. For the first time in his life he felt himself to be loved. He wept with delight and went to hide his tears in the great woods above Verrières. Why do I find myself in this state? He asked himself at last. I feel that I would give my life 100 times over for this good curé Chelan, yet he has demonstrated to me that I am no more than a fool. It is him above all that I ought to deceive, and he sees right through me. This hidden flame he talks about, it's my ambition to make my fortune. He thinks me unworthy of being a priest, and that at the very moment when I thought the sacrifice of an income of 50 louis would have given him the highest notion of my piety and my vocation. In the future, went on Julian, I will rely on those parts of my character I have tested. Who would have thought I would have found pleasure in shedding tears, that I would love someone who shows me that I am no better than a fool? 3 days later, Julian had hit on the pretext with which he should have armed himself from the start. This pretext was a calumny. But what does that matter? He told the curé with much hesitation that from the very first there had been a reason deterring him from the projected marriage, which, because it was detrimental to another, he had been unable to explain to him. This amounted to impugning Eliza's conduct. Monsieur Chelan was conscious of a certain worldly vehemence in his manner, very far from that which should animate a youthful Levite. My friend, he advised once more, become a good independent country dweller, worthy and educated, rather than a priest without vocation. So far as language went, Julian responded very cleverly to these renewed remonstrances. He found words which a fervent young seminarist might have used, but his tone in deploying them, and the ill-conceived passion that shone from his eyes, alarmed Monsieur Chelan. It is unnecessary to fear for Julian's future. He worked out the correct direction for a cunning and cautious hypocrisy, not too bad considering his age. As to the tone and gestures, he lived with country folk. He had been deprived of sight of the great models. Later, he needed hardly to come near these gentlemen before he excelled in gesture as well as words. Madame de Renal was amazed that her maid's new prosperity failed to make the girl happier. She saw her constantly going to see the curé and returning with tears in her eyes. Eventually, Eliza spoke to her about her marriage. Madame de Renal felt herself to be ill. A kind of fever prevented her from sleeping. She awoke to existence only when her maid or Julian was under her eyes. All she could think of was them and the happiness they would find together. The poverty of their little house, where one had to live on an income of 50 louis, presented itself to her in ravishing colours. Julian could very well make himself an advocate in Bray. The sub-prefecture, 2 leagues from Verrières, in which case she would sometimes see him. Madame de Renal sincerely believed that she was on the way to becoming insane. She told her husband of it and eventually fell ill. The same evening, as her maid waited on her, she saw that the girl was in tears. She loathed Eliza at that moment and had been short with her. She asked her pardon. Eliza's tears redoubled. She said that if her mistress would permit it, she would tell her all her unhappiness. "Well, tell me," replied Madame de Renal. "Oh, well, madame, he has refused me. Some wicked people must have spoken ill of me, and he has believed them." "Who has refused you?" said Madame de Renal, scarcely breathing. "Oh, who, madame, if not Monsieur Julien," replied the lady's maid, sobbing. "Monsieur le Curé cannot overcome his resistance, for Monsieur le Curé thinks that he ought not to refuse an honest girl, under the pretext that she's been a lady's maid. After all, Monsieur Julien's father is no more than a carpenter, and himself, how did he make his living before entering madame's house?" Madame de Renal heard no more. An excess of happiness had almost robbed her of reason. She made her maid repeat time after time that Julien had refused in a definite manner, and on which would not allow him to change back to a wiser course. "I want to try one last effort," she said to her maid. "I'll talk to Monsieur Julien." All right, that's a good spot to stop. And we'll continue after breakfast. Thanks very much for listening. Have your say over at the subreddit, and I'll see you tomorrow.